This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to another Psychobatical podcast with me, your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. As you can hear, I'm not recording this one beside a motorway or walking along. I'm actually in my flat. I was going to try and record an interview yesterday with a friend of mine, Pete Rhodes, who's trying to build a boat. So he's going to row across the Atlantic, the North Atlantic, which is kind of tougher than the, you know, going across the middle. But unfortunately, I seem to be living in this like podcasting dystopia where everywhere I was trying to get a good signal to have a conversation with him, it didn't work. So and where there was a good signal, like I ended up going to McDonald's, and but there was like too many kids shouting and screaming, so I can't record it there. So I'll have to put that aside for a while till I can find a good signal. But I'm actually in my house, and I got up early this morning to record this podcast, and I thought, like, here, like, it'll be like the call to prayer is about sort of 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, so I'll get up after that, and because it's like actually quite loud, the call to prayer, because you have all these there's like mosques like everywhere, like every 500 meters is a mosque, so you've got like 4 mosques around you, and then there's like all these other ones. So this call to prayer begins, and it's just this like kind of sort of really strange kind of noise because they all kind of mix together. But so that generally wakes you up in the morning anyway. So anyway, so I got up and I thought that'd be great. I'll get up and I'll do my podcast, and it'll be quiet. And of course, like, my next door neighbor was on his turbo at like 6 in the morning next door, like for like quite a long time. So anyway, so I so it's quite tricky, this podcasting thing, like recording it, like getting the levels right and everything else. It's more, there's more to it than I thought, really. So it's an ongoing process, and I'm slowly working it out. Just checking, I'm actually recording this. Yeah, that's true. I've had some really good responses so far to this whatever this is, but a few negatives about not rambling too much, to stop rambling. I'm a kind of a rambly kind of person. I was going to read, because someone said, oh, I really like your writing, but I find you kind of rambly when you're talking. And I have this weird thing. I remember a few years ago, long time ago, I did this talk in Boulder, Colorado, and I'd done all this like writing that appeared in like American climbing magazines. And I turned up to do this slideshow for the Alpinist magazine. And the organizer, Christian Beckworth, he was like, he didn't really believe I was the same person, because like, how I wrote was this like really, really serious, considered, you know, sort of studious kind of, you know, person. But then the person who turned up with this kind of slightly, you know, sort of, you know, nut job kind of random, you know, inappropriate kind of person. And he said there was no connection between these two people, like the writing person and the I don't know, it's not even the public person, because when you're on a stage, the person you portray, or well when you're on a, I should say when you're on a stage is whenever you're performing and you're, and I would say most people are performing the whole time, any interaction with someone else, they're exactly the same as being on a stage. They're always performing. So the person who was performing was not like the person who was writing. But the reality of all these things is the real person, the real me, is somewhere in between the two, like the stage persona and the writing persona. But I think the writing is probably a little bit more who I really am. But with the good thing about writing is that you can sit down and you can, you know, you have like a lot of time to really consider your words and get your thoughts into some kind of order. And it's like writing code or something. You're trying to impart this some kind of message or something. So it's, you've got a lot more time. So that's, for me, like, right, the problem with me for writing is it takes a long time to write something. And when you're standing on a stage, if you're doing a performance on a stage, last time I was on tour, I think I did like the same basic talk about 35 times. So by the second time, you've got like the foundation of what you're going to be talking about, because you have all these slides behind you, so you can like, they're like a reference point for where you are, like a grid reference for where you are in your sort of slideshow, your performance. So by the second time, you've got like all the groundwork of what was working. But it's the same when you're in a conversation. Last night I went to a climbing wall here, which is like, well, it's not really a climbing wall, it's like a climbing wall. It's like, it's there, you know, maybe like 3 meters high by like 3 meters wide. And there's all these, you know, people there like trying to climb on this like tiny little bouldering wall. And that's the only climbing here. But you realize that when you're having these conversations with people, you're basically repeating a conversation you've had with someone else, you know, to all these, you know, you're just performing this, you know, you tell the same stories and you tell the same anecdotes. Like, I always have this anecdote about someone was talking about grades in America, and I was like, oh, I know these people, and they were climbing, these Norwegians, and they were climbing, and it was like really, they were really hard, they found the roots really hard in Yosemite, and they didn't understand why. And then one day someone said, like, well, look, let me show me the roots. And they're like, well, these roots, we're doing these roots. Oh my God, they're like death roots. Look, it says like no pro. And they thought it meant no problem. And so I must have told that story like a million times. And I don't even, it's actually a secondhand story from somebody else, but I always tell it like it was some friends of mine. But this story is like a block of code in a way. And it's just there in your, you know, like you're, you just pull it out and you just repeat the story. But with the podcast, because it's not necessarily pre-constructed what you're going to say, and often you're in a situation where, like the last one, you know, you're like freezing your ass off and you're outside a coffee shop at 8 a.m. and the traffic's going by and you're trying not to speak too loud. Like, you can't, like here in this country, you can't really walk around taking photographs with a camera or ever pay too much attention to anything. Like, I've basically got this voice recorder, which has got two metal prongs at the end, and it looks a bit like a taser. So it's kind of getting me into quite a lot of trouble. Like, there's a lot of security here. So if you try and go into like a mall and they open your bag and they say like, what's this? And I was trying to demonstrate that I was like holding it in my hand, like, hello, hello, hello. And then I was like pretending to like taser myself with it and then say, no, 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 no. But it was like, the guy was getting so confused. I think he was going to like shoot me or something. But luckily some guy came along who could speak English. He was trying to explain. But, so I don't have a plug-in for that conversation that this is not a taser. So when you're podcasting in like a public place, because it's quite hard to find a good place to do this, you can hear it when I listen back to myself speaking. It's kind of, it's weird. It doesn't sound like me. Another thing I've realized is, I've been doing this periodic fasting kind of thing. So not eating anything for like 16 hours at a time, like just like in the week, because I was thinking it was very good for my like mental clarity or whatever. But what I failed to realize, I've been doing this for quite a long time, was I was actually still drinking like mint tea or green tea and things like that when I was doing this sort of fasting. But then I found out that's not actually the way to do it. You can't really have anything like that. So I've been doing it like a more serious kind of fasting where, and I found that it's actually had like a detrimental effect on my brain, in that I've had real problems with recalling words. Like if you listen to some of my podcasts, I'm having a real hard time remembering like really, really simple words. And I've basically put it down to this periodic fasting. So I'm going to have to modify my periodic fasting. But it actually worked quite well with mint tea. So we shall see about that. But before I crack on with what I'm going to talk about, one issue I've been thinking a lot about recently, I've been reading books about the 19th century for some reason. Like I read this book a while ago, Weapons of Mass Instruction, which is about the education, which I highly recommend. I'm always surprised that teachers have never read this book, because it is a really fantastic book. And it was written by an award-winning, one of the best teachers like working in New York, who left the teaching profession, wrote this book, kind of a damning, you know, sort of book about modern education. And he sort of draws some parallels back to, he talks about Bismarck and and how Bismarck's effect on education, and Otto von Bismarck. And Bismarck is, he's also a big character in one of my favorite books, which is The 48 Laws of Power, which sounds like one of these like bullshit books you buy in an airport, but it's actually not. It's actually a really good book. It's the number one book. It was a number one book in American prisons. I think it's banned there now. Anyway, highly recommend it as an audio book if you're driving around. Great for kids. It's got some amazing, just so many great stories in there. One of my favorite stories in there, I'll share it, because, you know, one of my favorite stories in there is, I can't remember who it was now, but it was Rockefeller. Like Rockefeller collected watches, and there was a watchmaker in New York, and he thought, I'll make this beautiful watch and I'll try and sell it to Rockefeller. So he makes this beautiful watch and he puts it in a box, and he has a letter and he has it sent to Rockefeller. And he says that, you know, this, if you want this watch, the watch is going to cost you $500. You know, this is the 1920s or something. So the watch goes away. Wears a few days. A few days later, Rockefeller's driver arrives, and he comes in, and he hands him the box with the watch inside. You know, it's just a wooden box, and he has this letter. And he hands him the letter, and he opens the letter, and it says, like, "Dear Mr. Watchmaker, this is a beautiful watch, but I feel it's only worth $400. If you feel that's fair, then please take this, you know, give the watch back to my driver, and I'll forward you a check for $400. And if not, then, please, you know, find your watch returned." And he's like, no, like, it's worth $500. I'm not willing to sell it for any cheaper than that. So the driver nods and walks out. And then the watchmaker opens the box. Inside is a check for $500. So there's lots of stories like that. There's a good book. But anyways, Bismarck's in this book quite a lot. Really amazing, politician. A lot of the world we live in is probably, you know, down to Bismarck. Like he introduced the idea of retirement at 65, basically, to try and get rid of all the old people out of work, so there's work for young people to try and deal with unemployment. The same way of like making extending education out to 21 as a way of trying to remove people from like the labor market, and all these kind of there's lots of really interesting things about Bismarck. So this is me not sticking to my non-random thing here. But anyway, reading about Bismarck, reading about basically like the time from like the French Revolution leading up to like the First World War, really, is a really interesting period to read, because you realize how, you know, the modern world is kind of constructed there, really. And most of Europeans were living under like serfdom, like a form of slavery, basically. So, but reading this made me think about the digital world we live in that. A few people have been like, "Oh, why don't you do your podcasts as like a video? And why don't you video it and stick it on YouTube?" And all these podcasts are on YouTube. but they're just like a static image there. And I've kind of come to this conclusion that basically when I started doing this kind of making a living as someone who's creating sort of content, whether it was writing for a magazine or whatever, you know, if you were good, you could basically get about $1 a word, where now you're basically getting $1 every 1,000 words or every 100,000 words. And in a way, you become like a serf, like a digital serf, in that you are producing all this content, like you're writing blogs and you're producing videos and you're doing podcasts and you're doing all these things, and it's all in the belief that you will get some kind of financial reward for doing it further down the line. You'll either become really famous and you'll be making $8 million out of, you know, Facebook, out of YouTube adverts, but only if you're doing something like opening presents or something. I was thinking you could have a video where you're just like masturbating, looking at pornography. I think that might actually be a huge growth industry, but unfortunately my wife doesn't agree. She'll probably say you do enough of that already. Anyway, so, you feel like you're trying to produce like really, really good content, and then you just look at like a child who's making $8 million just opening presents, opening boxes on YouTube, and you think, what's kind of the point? I feel like I'm getting to this point where I feel like it's maybe time to start withdrawing that kind of, to just be like producing content, because you're I think it's really important in your life to be a happy person is to serve somebody else. So like, I think Bob Dylan's got that really good song about you've got to serve somebody. And I think that is probably one of the core ways to be happy as a person, like serve your community or, you know. So I've always felt like I served like the climbing community. And in this book I'm trying to finish at the moment, like that, you know, that is directly, that's not necessarily about making money out of writing a book about abseiling and how not to die abseiling, but it is primarily about serving your community, and hopefully in the process that your community buys it and you know sustains you as someone who is serving the community, like it's a, you know. So So the podcasting thing is easy because I just have to sit down and do it. I don't have to spend like hours and hours and hours like writing something that just is just taken for granted in a way, because everything's just taken for granted. I take everything for granted. I listen to, you know, all these podcasts, and it's very, very rare. Like I give some money to like Wikipedia, and I give some money to various, you know, certain people who I think are producing good content, but then there's so many people you don't, because it's just kind of there, really. And hopefully the people who, you know, hopefully the people you listen to, you know, like your Sam Harris's and people like that, you know, it works out really well for them. But it's an interesting thing. I was thinking about just getting rid of all that kind of social media stuff and just having your blog. Like, you know, there's no way to find any content apart from on that blog. Like at the moment, I'm also trying to revamp my website, and I'm changing it over into different sort of content management system, and it's going to be it's going to work a lot better, hopefully. I think we are like in a weird sort of stage for like information and how we, like, this has been a long-term issue of like how you pay for good content. Like this book I'm writing, you know, it's like 70,000 words. It'd be amazing to make it like open source and just have it all on my website. So, you know, it'd be like the ultimate resource for climbing, for people not dying climbing. There's a few websites out there that have like an article or whatever, but this is like so in depth, and also it's, you know, you could keep expanding it, you could keep modifying it, you could have like a wiki, and it could do the same with like the big wall book, which is like 300,000 words, and you could just all be there. But to give it away for free would be insane, because it's just taken you, you know, a year of your life to do it. Like the only way it could ever work was if people, you know, you'd have to try and work out the value of something over like a long period. So it's never going to happen. But anyway, since, you know, I don't know how these things are going to resolve themselves, but they will. So, but anyway, I thought because I couldn't talk to Pete on the phone, and I didn't want to be rambling on too much. So hopefully I've not been rambling on too much. Hopefully I've got like the rest of the wasn't point to what I just said then. I'm going to read something, which was a little blog post I did, and I'm just going to sort of add a few words to it because it kind of been on my mind a little bit. So this was a podcast on my, a post on my website, which I think it was called like Little Anita Needs to Fly, which is a play on the Werner Herzog film. I'm going to read you the post and I'll kind of talk about it. Okay. I probably get two messages a day from someone who wants to do a climb or a trip of their lives, to climb a big wall, to pack in their job they hate and go somewhere wild, dreams big and small, some doable, some less so. The message I got from Anita from Romania was sort of typical. Someone who wanted to climb El Cap, but really had zero experience of big wall climbing, only a copy of my book, Higher Education. What stood out in her email was this paragraph. 8 months ago, when I fractured both my legs and my cervical, in brackets, the doctor told me I wouldn't be able to climb this year and actually should give up, but I knew they didn't know what is climbing, so I didn't listen to them. However, it was really hard. I cried a lot. Then in the middle of August, I started to lead. I was so afraid of falling. In the few messages I got back and forth, I tried to sound like the voice of reason, to be the one who said, calm the fuck down, as I thought she was probably someone who had too high a romantic notion of climbing a big wall. But once she got on one, she'd fold, because most people do. But then there was this part of how she talked, like nothing was going to stop her, not the doctors, not me, not reality. And then yesterday I got this email. Hi, Andy. I think it is really funny what happened, so I thought maybe I should write two or three words about it. Well, in all, it was good, but the grades in Yosemite are much harder compared to Europe. I felt okay on 5.7, but on 5.8, I wasn't so confident. First, we tried the nose as a 3. We haven't climbed together. We also didn't know what a whole system to use. We had a 140-meter rope because we thought that was one of the rope will go one follower while the leader is doing the hauling on the other end. Well, it was a fiasco. The rope tangled up so badly that it took us 3 hours to untangle it. So we bailed. I insisted to not, but the guys wanted and they didn't listen to me and I was the most inexperienced. I insisted on trying again. So the next time our haul bags were lighter without a portal edge and a lot of unnecessary stuff. We did the whole system 1-1, not 3-1. It was way faster. As for my first big wall and my first aid climb, I did the pancake flake and it was a bit scary. I didn't even know the sizes of our gear. Haven't used alien offsets before or totems or brass nuts or cam hooks. But on that pitch, I used everything. Thanks for your higher education book. Even though I didn't have any experience with them, at least from the photos and the descriptions helped me finalize the pitch. A bit slow, but in control, because theoretically, I knew what I have to do. That was really useful. It was hard, the whole Jumaring everything, but I kept reminding myself what you wrote in your book. Just don't haul, keep moving. And you forgot to tell us about the possibility that a mouse can eat your food on the wall, or maybe I didn't notice it. So at camp four, where we bivvied, in brackets, the worst bivvy in my life, I just tried to sleep, hanging in my harness, because I offered the old guy the good bivvy place, as he had some back issues. As the mouse ate our bread, we were tight on food. The third day, we were before dark at camp six, fixed the rope on the changing corner, where everything smelt like piss, and for the next day, bad weather was announced, and we thought to give a push to the top. So from camp five, we did a 24-hour push. From camp four, we did a 24-hour push to the top. In the night, it was very windy. Also, the whole valley was evacuated because of the strong winds. We were frozen at the top. Then we slept for 4 hours, and that was it. thanks for a lot of everything, Andy. Just keep writing. You inspire me a lot. I really like the idea of aid climbing and want to learn more about it. Have a nice day, Anita. So Anita was this sort of crazy Romanian woman, and I had this, you know, she sent me some of these photographs of her laid in bed with like two broken legs and a broken pelvis, and like reading between the lines, it just sounded like one of these people where they have this incredible drive, like they find climbing. And I would say, like, Vanessa, my wife, is one of these people, is where they find this thing, this climbing thing, and it like makes complete sense. And it just is like you find this community of people, you find this history, you find this, you know, you've got like you've got this endless amount of fruit, you've got the low hanging fruit, and the tree gets higher and higher and higher, and you've just, you know, you get good really, really quickly, and you're learning new skills, and the skills, the amount you can learn is just, you know, like endless. You know, you can get good at sport climbing, then you can get good at trad climbing, then you get good at ice climbing, then you get good at big wall climbing, then you can go on expeditions, and you can go, you know, it's just like you're always learning something the whole time. So it's, you know, like an amazing sport, like climbing and mountaineering. And she was one of these people where she's probably, you know, some people are like very high achievers, or they just really throw themselves into something. So they were really good at running, or they're really good at gymnastics, and then they get to climbing, and they get really good at climbing, and they're just, you know, they're just like a sponge. And climbing, when people like discover climbing later on, because usually when you're young and you discover climbing, you're sort of introduced to climb by somebody else, and that person has gone through these phases themselves, and they will kind of put a little bit of a break on your enthusiasm, and they will make you go through the process, and they will make you learn how to be safe, and they'll harness that energy you have, so it's focus, and it's not going to kill you, basically. But I think if you discover climbing when you're an adult, you don't have that, and people are less likely to say to you, like, look, you know, you just need to calm the fuck down, you know, stop, you don't want to be, don't be soloing around, and don't be finding it funny that all your gear falls out, whatever, you know. And you need that kind of, you need that sort of calming force in your life. And that's why it's quite good to be part of a climbing club, or to have that influence. If it's just you and your friend and you're just getting into climbing, it's actually really, really, it's kind of really, really dangerous. Me and my friend are going to learn how to do paragliding or parachuting. We're just going to buy a parachute and just start working it out as we go along. And really, you really need someone who knows about parachuting to sort of give you some guidance to do that kind of thing. And what happens is people generally, luckily, like climbing as an ability to, you know, someone said, you're not, you know, like Mike Tyson said, everyone's got a plan till you get punched in the face. And I think that happens in climbing, is that generally most climbers have like a really, really terrifying experience, like a massive fall or something which really recalibrates their view of themselves as a human being, as a climber. And that either like stops them climbing, they just give up climbing, or it makes them like take it more seriously, and it makes them a much better climber. So with Vanessa, my wife, she was a slightly gung-ho kind of climber. And I always, you know, like I was the person who was, she was part of a climbing club in Ireland. And that had a really good influence on her. Like, you know, had these older climbers who were telling her to calm down. And what's interesting, I've had a few conversations with people, women, generally women climbers, who felt that men were being patronizing to them directly because they were telling them to calm the fuck down. I think they saw this as being like men telling women to not, you know, but I don't think it is like that, because I've seen men say the same thing to young guys and stuff. And it's probably more dangerous that people don't say anything because they don't want to sound like a sexist asshole or something. So, you know, like experience, I don't know, you just got to like apply when people tell you these things. Are they saying this because, you know, like if you know, Anyway, it's a difficult subject. I just think you're better to sound like a sexist asshole and save someone's life, or you know, make someone safer than not say it. So, like, I've seen it. I've experienced it myself when I've been in Yosemite. You know, like, I've climbed El Cap 30 times or something. I have quite a lot of experience. Like, I've written books about it. And I would sit, and generally, if you saw like two guys like gearing up, like in the car park or whatever, you go up and like, oh, what are you up to? And then they're going to do this, the shield or whatever. And you'd be like, oh, you need, you know, just, I don't know if you, you know, just a bit of advice, like this bit's here or blah, 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 blah. But generally, when I'd see like two women doing that, more now than in the past, like Jen Randall, who I made the film Psycho Vertical with, that's how I met her, because she and a friend were like going to do the nose or something. And they've been failing on the nose loads and loads of times. You know, they're like two or three failures climbing El Cap. And I went over there and I was like having a conversation with them. I was giving them some advice, and other people give them advice, and then they end up doing it. But at that time, you know, it was only, you know, 2013 or something, 2012, you know, you weren't in that space where you felt like you're being a sexist asshole or something, or misogynistic or something. So where now you feel less able to do that, because you don't want to sound like one of those kind of people, which is a real shame, because I ended up climbing El Cap that many times because I had the advice of all these people who came up and told us things when we were learning how to do it. So anyway, so I think just do it, just say it, just give people advice to people in the right way. And that's anyway. So with Vanessa, I remember we did a route in Squamish. It was like a 510, I think it was a 510D, like big slabby multi-pitch climb in Squamish. And it was, I ended up being really, really dirty and really, really run out. And she had this, for some reason, she was on like the last pitch, and she was basically, the bolts were like massively spaced apart, and it was quite a kind of very, very friction climbing, but also the rock was like dirty, and she basically got off route, and she ended up way off, just with no gear whatsoever, and she ended up in this position where there was like a bush like hanging down, but like one strand of like a vine was hanging down. And she ended up like basically grabbing this vine, and basically, you know, this vine was like a vine, you know, and she basically started sort of like smearing up this thing, holding on to like one, almost like one leaf at a time, pulling herself up this thing. And she managed to get to some safety, to a tree, made a beeler. But that really like wiped out her, this crazy, you know, crazy kind of confidence she had, which was really good. It kind of, you know, it was very good. And that's what happens to most climbers, have this thing where they, you know, so Anita was another one of these climbers. You could read what she'd done, that she'd, you know, basically pushing it, fallen off, broken both of her legs. Like luckily she didn't die. But that hadn't really taken the edge off her. You know, she was still like, maybe because of the accident, she was even like some, I know climbers who've like had like horrific falls where they fell, you know, like 30 meters and decked out and were just like smashed to pieces. But then they sometimes have this kind of survivors kind of thing where they can't be killed. It's like weird, like human beings are weird. They just seem that they're invincible because they survived this fall, where other people will be like, fucking hell, I nearly died, I'm not doing that again. So, but she's from what she was reading, there was all these reasons why she shouldn't go and climb El Cap. And I kind of laid them all out, like, you've got no experience. But El Cap is kind of, you know, big wall climbing is kind of weird because it really is actually quite easy. But it's just like a huge amount of work and a huge amount of fannying on and like hassle and trying to, and it's not only your, like, that's why soloing a big wall is actually a lot easier than climbing it with someone else, because it's the other people who, all the shit they bring along as well, that can generally it's not El Cap that beats you. It's like, it's, you beat yourself, and you know, if you've got a partner who isn't enjoying being there, or is like way better than you, or way worse than you, then you're fighting with that person, really, and that's what makes you come down. And she had all sorts of reasons why she shouldn't try the nose, and I tried to do the you know, I try and be like the voice of reason these days. And I was like, you know, well, maybe you should go up there and you should do, you know, as much climbing as you can. And maybe you should do some other routes. You could do like Leaning Tower or some other routes. But then that's not what I did. You know, we went there and we got on the shield like day two or day one or something. And we started climbing up the shield and we kind of made loads of mistakes and sort of learned that way. So by, you know, at the beginning we were like complete, you know, like novice big wall climbers. But by the top of the, when we got to the shield, at the top of the shield, we're actually pretty good. You know, we kind of knew, well, we thought we knew what we're doing. But you never really do. You never know what you're doing. So I was trying to be like the voice of reason. But at the same time, you're like, this person, they have so much drive that they probably can do it. But then it's like, what, you know, what's her base of skills? So I often remember this young guy who was telling me he wanted to climb, you know, climb in Yosemite, climb a big wall. And I was like, yeah, you can do it. You know, it's like easy. Don't worry about it. You know, it's like, it's fine. And he basically went out there and I think he was like fixing ropes on Leaning Tower or one of those kind of walls, easier walls. And none of them are easy, but like an easier wall in Yosemite. And as he was wrapping down he was fixing his ropes, he just wrapped off the end of the rope and he fell. And luckily he only broke his arm, got really bashed up and broke his arm. But that was like, for me, that was like, that checked me in that don't assume that just because someone's really enthusiastic and you've sort of contaminated them with your enthusiasm that they can do it, that they actually have all the base skills like necessary. Like they may understand some big things, you know, they may know how to put a portal edge up, but they may not know about tying a knot in the end of the rope, or they may just not be like the right stuff for that kind of thing. But some people can, some people can learn like really, really quickly. Like Vanessa, I think she's climbed El Cap like five times. And the last route we did was Tribal Right, which is quite hard. I would say it was like A3 plus A4 kind of sort of climbing. You know, it's like super long. And, she did some really hard pitches and she was kind of learning as she was doing it because she's like super smart. She could, you know, slightly work it out. But then sometimes she took some falls because she just made like dumb mistakes because, you know, like aid climbing is a bit like defusing a bomb. You know, you really have to have your, you know, really understand, you know, where your pliers are and where, you know, how these things connect to each other. And, it doesn't really forgive mistakes that much, aid climbing. You've got so much gear and even if you take a fall and rip out loads of gear, you're not going to kill yourself. But there was a few bits. I remember there was a bit where she was climbing up a pitch and she basically started heading off on all these tiny little flakes, which were really hollow. Like that, you know, it was like a plate, like you'd eat your dinner off, like that thin, just like all kind of stuck on the wall. And I was like, I don't think it should be going up there. And she's like, no, it's like, I can't see it. And I'm like, look, it's supposed to be some like sky hooking, you know, going left. And she's like, I can't see anything. And, anyway, she ended up like down climbing this thing. And there were some obvious sky hooking placements to go around to avoid them. And she just didn't have that experience of knowing what a sky hook placement would look like. You know, I don't know what she thought she was looking for, but it's like slowly building up. It's like sediments of experience, like slowly, slowly building them up. So when you get to that point where you're having to place a copperhead or you're having to, dry tool up some mixed ground or like rescue someone, you know, you've sort of built up enough experience that you can sort of work it out. But if you're missing all that, then it's you can have all the knowledge, you can read all the books, but it's being able to bring that up, bring those bits of knowledge together and put them into action, which is really important. So when I published this story about Anita, it was more as a way of like, because lots of people have like dreams and goals, and some of them are actually quite, you know, like a really, 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 really easy to do. but you just need someone to, you know, kind of need permission from someone else to say you can do them. And I think, you know, most people I meet could climb El Capitan, or they could ski across Greenland, or they could ski to the South Pole or whatever. They could do all these things, climb Everest. But it's having that kind of that fire inside them. And that once you get there, often the fire is like an illusion, really. You get there and you're like, oh, fuck this, I'm not doing up there, I'm not doing that. You know, like the rational kind of self-preservation like returns to you. So there's only, out of the 80-20 rule is probably in force, like only 20% of people would really want to climb El Cap. And out of that 20%, 80% would probably fail for some reason. So the fact that Anita went there, and what is more interesting to learn from Anita's story was the drive that she had. It was probably driving the team of people in the other climbers were more experienced. So she had she was like a bubble. She was surrounded by more experienced climbers. But what those climbers, like climbers who are maybe older than her, more experienced than her, what they lacked was that fire. So often an older climber hasn't got the fire, but they find a younger climber without as much experience, but has the fire, and it kind of stokes them up, you know, like, she really wants to do it, and she's telling us we have to go back and we have to go up there, and she's like, so such a pain in the ass, but like, you know, she's kind of right, you know, and it kind of drives people on. That's why it's quite good to have, you know, like older climbers and younger climbers like climb together or working together or doing, you know, because it just creates that you have these two different views of things. So, you know, like it was one of the, you know, that climb, you know, at the time there was these like massive winds and also people in Yosemite, and it was like, it sounds like pretty hairy up there. And, you know, they managed to get away with it. But, you know, if it had started, you know, like raining or snowing, and, you know, they'd really pushed themselves, and it sounds like they'd run out of food. I think in my book it actually says about beware of mice eating your food, and also beware of mice having a shit in your pans, which is even worse. Don't ever let mouse shit in your food, make you a bit ill. So, you know, with all these things, you know, when it all works out, it's amazing. You know, like, oh, that's amazing. And when it doesn't, it's like, you fucking idiot. What were you thinking? So it's like, you know, there's a very fine line between stupidity and like heroism. So the one thing that is most troubling about Anita and this story is what she does next. You know, what people do next, because they in a way they're kind of delusional. In a way, they just have this this crazy enthusiasm, and it's instead of being like it's been tried to be checked once by breaking both your legs, and then you kind of push through that, and then you've decided you're going to climb El Cap, and you have climbed El Cap, and then the next stage is probably like, I'm going to climb Everest or something. So hopefully eventually you're going to hit like a log jam, and the log jam is going to stop you, and it's going to give you time to consider and allow some space for all that experience you need to overcome this log jam, you know, to learn how to use a chainsaw, learn how to climb over, you know, remove these trees from in front of you to carry on your journey, without basically getting crushed or drowned. But the thing is, you can't really, you have no control over people. You know, you can just try and your best to tell people, you know, pass on, if you're serving the climbing community and serving climbers and serving people, all you can do is try to be the voice of reason and try and give as much advice as you can and try and fill in all these gaps that you had to learn the hard way. And hopefully they can, if they can learn it an easier way and hopefully put it into practice and learn it, you know, understand what it actually means, then they have more time to climb harder or learn extra stuff or, you know, it's a difficult one is when you're that person who is not in, you know, when you're the motivating motivating force in someone else's life when their own motivation could kill them or end up, you know, putting them in a wheelchair or whatever. It's difficult, really, but it's. I think you can just do what you do and just try and be try and pull the reins back a little bit and try and keep them safe. So what's the moral of this story? I guess the moral of the story is a bit like the safety, the one about staying alive, like the second podcast I did. I guess it's about trying to apply a positive influence on younger climbers or climbers, you know, the same age, but people, they don't destroy, don't like put out that person's fire, but either exploit it for your own ambitions, what you want to do, or just try and get them to harness it a little better, because if it does turn out badly for them, you know, it's a horrible, you know, guilt to kind of carry that you had an opportunity to try and, you know, help someone to gain the benefit from this, you know, crazy enthusiasm someone has, because really it's just like a fire that can be applied to anything. You know, if that person stops climbing, they can apply it to, you know, whatever they're doing. It's just you know, like 50% of it is just in your DNA. I think that, you know, people like that who have this amazing drive and focus and things. So anyway, so that's the end of this podcast. I'm less rambly, hopefully, and less noisy. There's no call to prayers going on or trucks beeping. So I'll do another podcast on Tuesday. I'm going to do one about, I had some questions about lanyards. It's super exciting. I know, lanyards. And not the ones that you have like your badge on, but like lanyards as in cow's tails and things. So thank you for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.